So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Bro, I've been doing this. I'm 25. I've been doing this for more than half my life. I'm gonna die in a fucking ring. You know?
I'd be happy. So every time you buy a ticket, know that that might be the night.
You might see me die, man. You might see me die one night.
I was in denial. You know, guys would call me up, like, I know Axel would be like, bro, what are you going to do? And I goes, I'm going to, dude, it's not, it's really not. I was in denial to the day it happened. So I finally got to Puerto Rico. I figured I was going to be there for a month or two, you know, and I'd work. So I went and got Soma, a lot of Soma, 160 of them. So that night, I 750 milliliter bottle of 51 rum. Stacy got a message, and she checked it the next day, of me counting 120, 121, 122, 123. And she said I got to 140 and said, now I'm dead, you bitch. I hope you're happy. And I was trying to kill myself. That's what ECW, remember, that's what it did to me. I did live, eat, breathe, shit, sleep. ECW, it was my life. I dedicated everything. Nothing made me happier than getting in ECW, right?
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting coming at you, and a big review today, Wei. We are going to be joined by a guest as we do our big review of Barbed Wire City, a fun documentary review.
What is Barbed Wire City?
It's the documentary we're going to review, and I hope you know what the documentary is.
Well, I wanted you to explain it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, it is the documentary that was recently released with directors John Filipowicz and Kevin Kiernan taking a look at ECW. And this has actually been they started shooting this in 2000. Mm-hmm. So 13 years later.
While ECW was still around.
So they had a lot of cool footage that they obtained from the mid-90s, from a lot of from a fan Q&A they held in 95, getting a lot of cool perspective of talking to guys when ECW went out of business, 12 years later, getting a lot of thoughts and sometimes a lot of different contradictions. So,
yeah.
And the fact that it took 13 years for them to put this out, that Nunavut documentary, we're only at 2 years.
That's right.
Yeah.
You got to let it simmer. You know? Maybe something big will happen to all those people and then it'll be that much more important.
The thing is, and for those that are maybe unfamiliar, like, what are you talking about? 2 years ago, we got invited by Art O'Cal to go follow a number of the Squared Circle wrestling crew.
A local independent promotion.
Yeah, they went to this cool area of Canada called Nunavut, which is a territory. And not a wrestling territory, a literal territory.
People in Canada, we don't have states, we have provinces. But we also have these things called territories.
Yes.
And why are they territories and not provinces? I have no clue.
There is some reason behind it, but my geography fails me at this point.
Basically, a territory is a place that nobody ever goes to.
Pretty much, unless you're wrestlers and therefore
Inuit.
Live entertainment is at a low. So going to Nunavut, they've gone there in the past. They invited us to go. So we decided to go on the trip, brought a camera, and we were going to just document this, not really knowing what we were going to get out of this. And
Colt Cabana was there.
Michael Elgin.
Matt Morgan.
Ashley Six. Matt Morgan. I'm trying to think of Tracy Brooks was there.
Jimmy Corderas.
Yeah. Scott D'Amore. Very fun time. We were there for, what, 2 days?
Yeah.
Two days?
3 days.
Yeah. Time was just
in the Arctic, basically.
In the Arctic. So it was – it only got dark for like 2 hours out of the 24-hour day.
And I believe that changes in the winter.
Yeah, then it's the opposite where it's like you get light for two or 3 hours.
We were there in the summer and, yeah, it was pretty much anyway, we'll save this for a different time. We don't have to talk about the whole thing. But anyway, we've been sitting on this footage for about 2 years now.
So anyway, we gotta put this together at some point. And I think we got a good like 45-minute documentary in us in that thing. We just have to sit down and fucking do this work.
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah.
It'll happen
one
day.
It'll happen, whatever. I'm in no rush.
Yeah. Every couple of months, I get a text from Arda. It's like, hey, how's the documentary coming along?
Maybe he can, work on it.
Maybe. We need some help on this. I'm dead.
Yeah.
In terms of workload. Anyway, we're going to review a documentary that did get finished, and that is Barbed Wire City.
Yeah, this was, I just read about it afterwards, but this was a big Kickstarter funded project, was it not?
Yes, it was. This was funded on Kickstarter. I remember it was like last summer, I think they reached their goal. And you could tell right away that this was, they put some production value into this. I really liked some of the 3D animation that they had for some of the photos. I mean, you're talking about, 20 years ago, where you're talking about the infancy of Eastern Championship Wrestling before it evolved into Extreme Championship Wrestling, which they placed a big focus on. But actually, before we get into like the thoughts on this documentary, which of the ECW documentaries have you seen? In Rise and Fall of ECW and Forever Hardcore? Because I had seen both, and
Didn't we review Forever Hardcore?
I don't think so.
I feel like we have. I feel like that was like maybe on an Ask Away or something.
You know what? You're probably right. We probably did review it at one point. Well, I told you about my trip to New Jersey and my Friday night of death. So just sitting in my hotel room. So I went on YouTube and Forever Hardcore was there and I watched the entire thing. I thought it'd be a good primer because I remember Rise and Fall of ECW fairly well, but Forever Hardcore, not as much. So I just watched it actually on the weekend.
And what are your thoughts now on Forever Hardcore? Because I think we're all in agreement that we both really enjoyed the WWE, the Rise and Fall.
I thought both really had its positives. I mean, the positive in Forever Hardcore was that Jeremy Borash
Independently produced the documentary.
And it came along right as the WWE was bringing back the brand, or at least doing that first one-night stand show. And then to combat it, Shane Douglas was trying to start the Hardcore Homecoming series of events. So it was like the voices you wanted to hear on the WWE version that were not there were on the unofficial ECW documentary that Borash put together. So between both documentaries, you heard a lot of these voices. It's interesting how the perspectives have changed. Like on the Forever Hardcore documentary, for instance, we've got Joey Styles just, very candid and very critical of a lot of the stuff in ECW. And kind of now he's an employee of the WWE. So it's interesting to look back in hindsight, especially at a time. What are we watching here? Like, we can't ignore this any longer. Is this... Like, I am watching a woman who is filling up her car with gas.
Holy shit.
Holy fuck.
This is...
This is Gabe Morenci's show, MMA Meltdown.
Yeah, we work in the Fight Network right here, and a number of shows get broadcast out of our offices, and we have basically a monitor looking into the studio, and one of the shows that's airing right now is called MMA Meltdown with Gabriel Morenci, and there's a viral video section, and they just played a video right now that we can clearly see of a woman filling up her gas tank, but her car starts driving away as she's filling up the tank, and so she's still, for some reason, holding onto the nozzle, and the car is pulling her away, along with the nozzle. This woman flies out of there.
She, like, flipped?
She does a flip, and then the nozzle breaks off, and then there's gasoline spilling everywhere. This is wild.
So, I want to see where the car went.
I'd like to know, too, so forgive us, everybody.
Okay, back to this documentary.
We're professionals here.
What I was really intrigued with Barbed Wire City is the fact that this was a documentary produced by, one guy who is a self-professed fan at heart, and the other in Kevin Kiernan, who is not a fan at all. And you also don't have really a horse in the race, so to speak. There was a reason the WWE was going to market an ECW DVD and restart the brand. And there was also an interest for Forever Hardcore to get these Hardcore Homecoming shows rolling, where it featured at the time a lot of guys who were working with TNA and were going to be part of these Hardcore Homecoming shows. This was kind of like there was no horse in the race for these two guys other than, they were going to document the history of ECW, much like the World Class DVD that Brian Harrison put out. It came out roughly the same time as the WWE version, and there were strengths to both in terms of production and access to guys, but I'm going to take the guy that's just kind of the journalist that's kind of documenting this stuff, and that's why I was interested to see this one at the when we got the copy sent to us.
When I first heard of this documentary was even being made, I thought, you know, okay, well, we've already really had two ECW documentaries. I mean, I feel like I pretty much know the story by now. Is there really a need for another one? But, you know, I've always been a documentary fan, especially a wrestling documentary fan, so I was looking forward to watching it. And after watching it, I mean, like you said, I feel like the first, the WWE-produced one, it's very much sort of a shinier, kind of a, I don't know, corporate type of feel of what that story was. That's the DVD with the, you know, all the major players, Tommy Dreamer,
Paul Heyman,
Taz. It's got everybody that you associate with.
And all the footage as well.
Whereas the Jeremy Borash one, it's almost it's all the other guys that are no longer friends with the company. They had zero footage at all, which I think was probably, you know, the weak point of that one. It's just the lack of production. And, you know, you're very handcuffed. And that's why I was so interested to see how this Barbed Wire City was able to handle that. And, man, they did an amazing job acquiring non-WWE-owned footage.
Yeah. That to me is one of the biggest strengths of this documentary is how, and you bring this up later in the interview with John, is the fact that never do you feel that, man, I wish they had so-and-so clip footage here to show you and illustrate what they're talking about. It felt like there was just constant stuff that they shot at the time, which was a huge benefit, rather than two people that were to start this documentary a year ago from scratch. You don't have all this archive footage that they were shooting back in 2000.
Well, like, watching Forever Hardcore, it, even though, like, a lot of the stories are, I remember being great, and, like, that in itself I thought was worth watching alone, it just felt like a lot of talking heads, you know, one after the other, just basically talking to you. And that's cool, too, but as a complete, I don't know, entertainment experience, I felt like this Barbed Wire City was able to kind of handle that, like, much better. Everything kind of flowed a lot better. Like you said, just going to the extent of animating the photos, I thought, I mean, obviously it took some money, it took some
sure.
people to do, and it did a tremendous job of, first of all, telling the story, but also keeping the momentum up throughout the whole thing.
One of the criticisms from some has been that there were just too many reporters on this thing. I mean, you had Dave Meltzer, Mike Johnson, Jason Powell, Wade Keller, Dave Scher. I find personally, just from, like, talking to a lot of wrestlers, I mean, the wrestlers, to me, are going to romanticize the most about this time period, and I liked having the reporters here who could kind of give you a much more factual account of things rather than, you know, everything was great back then. I mean, they kind of helped kind of, you know, tie in stories together and add the factual aspects.
I don't get why that would be a criticism. I mean, these are the historians.
These were from some of the people, like Dave Meltzer and Mike Johnson, felt they were in it too much.
Oh, really? I don't think so.
Maybe I think that's just a natural reaction of a journalist, is that I shouldn't be the focus.
Perhaps, yeah. But, I mean, you watch any type of documentary of this type, like VH1 Behind the Music. I mean, it's basically the story is being told by the people, you know, who have written autobiographies, the people who have followed these industries. Like, honestly, who has a better perspective?
I personally want to hear from guys that were covering this at the time and don't really have any reason to absolutely are not going to lie. I mean, these guys are built on their credibility. That's what I want to hear more from, rather than someone who didn't get paid at the end of ECW and thus have a negative image of their whole time there.
I thought they added a lot, and it wasn't like they were all of the same voice either. Like, in particular, I thought, like, Wade Keller was, like, you know, pretty critical of a lot of what was going on. And they all kind of provided their own little voice, and I thought they added a lot to the documentary.
In terms of the wrestlers, who did you find came off really well, and conversely, who maybe did not? Because I had a few in both categories.
I feel like almost everybody came off well. Okay, I can't say everybody. I would say the standouts definitely are Axel Rotten, who's quite prominently featured in this.
Very much, you know? So, in terms of representing kind of the violent aspect that ECW produced, and I you can't leave this documentary, I think, without looking at his comments from the time when ECW was running, and then looking at him present day right now. He's battling Bell's palsy, still working independent shots.
That's something we didn't really get into yet, but this documentary basically, it's a documentary about, you know, the history of ECW, but it also juxtaposes it with the days and the events leading up to the 2012, what is it, Extreme Reunion show held by Shane Douglas. So throughout this storytelling of the history of ECW, we get clips of, you know, the present day. You know, was this WrestleMania weekend?
No, it was a couple of weeks after WrestleMania last year.
We fast forward throughout the movie to April of 2012 and Shane Douglas heading into this arena, putting on this show. Sabu, getting the call that Sabu is passed out in this hotel room the day before the show and things like that. So it was especially interesting to see, you know, Axel Rotten, his progression from being, you know, 12, 13 years earlier. Still very much, involved in ECW at the time to where he is now. Still wrestling, but still basically living off of that same persona. And we kind of get into it in the interview, but you can kind of see that as either kind of happy or kind of sad.
I took it as, you know, yeah, you can take both emotions away from it. I liked kind of the contrast where you feel so many of these wrestlers are just trying to relive that magic that once was in ECW, which is a huge part of the documentary. And then looking at this show, which, you know, at the time, I mean, this show was pretty well a disaster. It drew very well. I think it did about 2,000 people, which is incredible for an independent show. Blows away what TNA is doing. But the bitter taste in people's mouth from that show was, you know, people just hated that show.
Yeah, and they definitely don't hide it in the documentary itself. Basically, they just show everything that went wrong in the show itself, how Sabu wasn't there, the people, while Shane Douglas comes into the ring, people chanting refund, all that stuff they kind of get into. I was going to say, like, earlier, you know, whereas the other two documentaries that came before, I felt very much told the story of the producers, of the performers. I thought this one was important because it told the stories of the fans. And I think that's probably maybe partly because, you know, John tells us later on in the interview that he originally set out to tell a story about the ECW arena itself and basically the culture surrounding ECW. And I think much of that is reflected in the interviews of the subjects that he chose. Because this guy went ahead and, like, I mean, Jesus, a profile on a Straw Hat Guy, a profile on, what is his name?
Ass Man. Remember him? Heyman gets him to moon
that
everybody?
Guy. And an interview with Tony Lewis.
Tony Lewis, yeah, who is... I really love when you can find people like this who you haven't really heard from on any kind of platform before, who was a huge part of, you know, campaigning these pay-per-view companies. And to me, one of the most emotional scenes in this whole documentary is the night of Extreme Reunion, where they talked to Tony Lewis, hadn't gone to any shows since ECW went out of business.
Explain who Tony Lewis is for people.
Well, Tony Lewis was just a fan who he ran this website during the run of the company called StrictlyECW.com. And when they were having trouble trying to get their pay-per-view, he started this grassroots campaign to contact these cable providers and really push for the company to get on. And he just spearheaded this whole movement and was credited as one of the, you know, the unsung heroes here of ECW, that the average person wouldn't be familiar with Tony Lewis. But he certainly gets his spotlight in this documentary. And the guy is moved to tears here during the Extreme Reunion show of just all the memories that are suddenly flooding this guy and seeing people he hadn't seen in 12 years.
And this is like the type of depth that I don't think you could ever find in a WWE produced DVD, where, you know, they're really like the WWE produced DVDs. To me, they feel like, okay, you have a team here who, you know, probably very good at production, probably very good at making television and, you know, editing and doing all this stuff. But I don't really feel that they are necessarily diehard fans at heart when I see people make, like, when I watch these DVDs. Whereas, you know, with a movie like this, you can definitely tell the producers, not only are they interested in the topic, but they lived through it and they are extremely passionate about it. I mean, I didn't even really know all that stuff about any of these fans, and it took something like this to kind of introduce all that to me.
And the audience was such a key, because as many guys that got signed by WWF and WCW and just plucked at will from ECW, the overall storyline in ECW was ECW versus everybody else. and these fans were a part of ECW. They were made to feel that you were part of this. And whether that was just brilliant manipulation that kept this audience returning, it was never what is the lineup at the ECW arena. It was like that was the event, was going to the ECW arena, where that in and of itself was part of the show.
Yeah.
And it became that, you know, these fans felt that they were part of some giant revolution, and this was changing wrestling. And it came at a time where people really did want something different. They presented something different. And that, to me, was always the key to ECW, which is, you know, hilarious in hindsight that here was a company that was getting subsidized to a small degree by the WWF at the time, the big giant monster that we're supposed to hate as ECW loyalists, was, you know, helping keep ECW going for a lot of those years and helping them out.
Yeah, and you know, I think everybody like kind of wonders, you know. You mentioned this in the interview. I thought it was a great point about how nobody ever looks back and says, you know, let's do a WCW one reunion. Let's do a WCW homecoming. Like nobody looks back at, I don't think, any era of wrestling with the amount of fondness that people look back at ECW at. And, you know, you try to look back and wonder why, what was so special about these few years of this company's existence. And I don't know. I feel like this documentary does a great job of just talking about just how, I mean, it was a company that was created by fans, and it really makes a point that the fans were part of the show. The fans were the show. You were there to, much like, you know, that Raw that we experienced a couple weeks back. You were there to mainly not just watch the wrestling. That was certainly a part of it, but I mean to be a part of that audience.
And it was also an ability, and this was, you know, to the strength of Paul Heyman, was being able to present these characters and make it really feel like this audience would believe that, you know, the WWF might be the big company in WCW, but Taz, if this was real, he would kill all of these guys. And Rob Van Dam is a better performer than anyone in the major companies. And it was, you know, a brilliant way of marketing these characters that, you know, kind of, you know, somewhat got it to a degree exposed when they would go to some of these companies, and then you would see them in a different light. Public Enemy is another one that they really present in this documentary as well, in terms of just what Paul was able to do with these characters, where these fans felt like, you know, this is our little secret. This is our underground band. They just pushed it, and it felt like you were as much a part of the locker room as these performers were.
Yeah. How do you think the topic of violence was handled in the documentary? Because, I mean, it really gets into how, like how ECW was really made a name for itself by, you know, going to more violent means to do their shows. And I think some of the journalists even make the point that they had to resort to violence because some of these guys that they were hiring weren't talented enough as technical wrestlers to make it through. But then, you know, towards the end, I'm just trying to figure out, you know, do you think the film makes a case that this violence was warranted, or do they make a case that maybe this was regretful, or does it make any type of case?
And I thought they kind of balanced that, and they kind of left the viewer kind of to decide here in terms of, you know, there was obviously a huge amount of violence that ECW was associated with, and that is the knee-jerk reaction of what ECW was. And they kind of do go into detail the fact that when they were firing on all cylinders, you know, they had, you know, pockets, you know, for the Benoits and the Mysterios and Psychosises to be focused upon, and the different storylines. But in terms of the actual violence part, I thought that was part of the most interesting, because I think that if you were someone that were just not familiar with ECW, you would look at this company as having, you know, its legacy is a lot of broken bodies, a death toll that a number of these performers paid, and they go into the concussion issue very heavily, of how these guys, they would take chair shots and think nothing of it. And, you know, you look at today, there's no way this promotion could be run the way it was in 1995, when you watch it with these 2013 eyes. It was I mean, I look back at it, of some of these guys, and I think Axel Rotten and Balls Mahoney, where you have the clip we played off the top, was Balls Mahoney in 1995 saying, "I'll probably die in the ring, and I'm fine with that." Mm-hmm. And then you look at a 2012 interview they conduct with him where he looks a mess. He looks like he's aged 40 years since 1995 and trying to kill himself while he's on, leaving a message for his wife. I mean, this is a...
Well, because he loved his company so much. Like, I don't take at all from this film that he regrets, except for the part where he says, you know, it was really stupid for me to cut up my arm like that. But I mean, I don't think he regrets his career at all. That's not what I took away.
They found a lot of guys who they lived for that pop and for that popularity. And I think a lot of guys, even, you know, looking at some of the worst cases, I think a lot of them would do it all over again.
Absolutely.
And they view this as the greatest years of their life, which is amazing to see, but it kind of gives you a glimpse into that mentality of what some of these performers live for, and, you know, very much like a drug that they can't have access to anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yeah. The film, you know, it talks about the success of ECW, but then it very gradually talks about the downfall of the company and how, you know, as they are striving towards getting pay-per-view, eventually they did. And then, you know, it wasn't necessarily the thing that turned business around. And it gets onto other successes, like getting onto TNN and then losing TNN, and how, you know, the video game deals, the action figure deals, none of that really, you know, was the holy grail like they all thought it would be.
No, it was, you know, kind of what we've seen with TNA, where it's always that elusive carrot that's dangling that, you know, if we get, you know, from Saturday nights, we're going to get onto Thursday nights. Then we're going to be in prime time. Then we're going to get 2 hours. Then we're going to go live on Monday nights. Yeah. And then you go live on Thursday nights. It's always something that they're grasping for. And really, you look at ECW at the time, which, even right at the end, I mean, towards the end of the TNN deal, I mean, they were still doing, you know, .9s on Friday nights, which was respectable on cable, and their pay-per-views were doing 90, 100,000 buys.
Wow.
I mean, imagine that. They
imagine
were
TNA doing that.
TNA, I mean, is doing 10% of that for their pay-per-view shows. I mean, it was incredible what they were able to do in terms of, you know, the limited audience they had, but converting them into pay-per-view dollars. I mean, their house shows were never, you know, gigantic successes, but for some shows they would do a couple thousand, which is, you know, you know, by today's standards, very respectable. But it just got to be, they just piled on so much. It was like watching you know, the TNN deal. It was like they outlined this very well, the fact that, and, you know, to get on TNN, first of all, they weren't getting any production money to put the show on, which to me is, you're already DOA when that's you know, television is great, but unless it's a you know, television deal that's going to help you. I mean, they had to put all these guys under contract, and it was just...
It was all their problems that they've already had, plus the successes of the big two swarming in on them at the same time.
And it was just like this arms race for WWF and WCW, who were just plucking all these guys. It forced Paul to have to, you know, sign these guys to whatever deals he could, which were probably not worth much more than the paper they were written on. And then getting on to TNN, it's funny, in the Forever Hardcore documentary, Joey Styles is just extremely critical of that very first ECW show, where it was taped matches from a couple months earlier. They aired the TNN show. They aired a Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn match from a pay-per-view a couple of months back, and they had a Kid Rock video and some promos, and it was just, if you're a WWF fan watching this for the first time, the production values are just not even in the same league.
I remember watching that very show and thinking that same thing. I mean,
you had a critical eye even in 99.
I'm sure anybody would, right? I mean, as a casual fan, because you're looking at, you know, just looking at it from just a completely foreign eye, you don't know that this crowd's really any special. I mean, you see it, these guys are loud, these guys look, you know, kind of like a bunch of frat boys, to be honest, like a bunch of people here. But then, like, you're not really exposed to the heart and, you know, the passion of these characters, these performers. And the cameras looked much shittier, And then the Kid Rock video, I thought it was pretty unnecessary. But yeah, yeah, I wasn't a big fan. Although, you know, I don't know. It's all about context. Who knows? Maybe if they presented it a bit differently, it would have been.
I found it hard at the time, you know, to really get invested in the product. It was like there was always a cool atmosphere to it, and that was always a positive that came across on television. But at the same time, it was like, you know, we complain about this all the time of, you know, when it comes to promoting pay-per-views and stuff. I mean, ECW, it was notorious that you'd maybe know one or two matches going into a pay-per-view, and the rest would kind of just fill out a card. And if you weren't on the internet, which I think they were relying on a lot of people to, you had no idea really what you were paying for. You'd have a handful of matches thrown out, but not really knowing what am I spending $30 on here. And I think just for trying to create a new audience, it's like you can't just assume that people are going to know what ECW is and the history of these characters and mm-hmm. and just jumping onto a new product that's in a not exactly advantageous time slot of Friday nights at 8 o'clock.
What did you think of the movie's portrayal of Paul Heyman?
I thought that they did a really good job in terms of...
By the way, Paul Heyman is not at all in this movie.
No, he's not in it at all. You know, names that are notably absent, of course, Taz, Tommy Dreamer, Rob Van Dam.
It seems like anybody affiliated within the past few years with TNA or WWE, I guess, except, you know...
Yeah.
Some of the WWE, ECW guys.
Paul Heyman, I thought, got a lot of praise, and he got a lot of criticism. And I think you can validate both sides there. I think there were people, I think the reporters gave a very much balanced view in terms of it. There were others, like New Jack, who was very interesting in the fact that he doesn't have any romanticized thoughts about ECW. It was a promotion that went out of business. He got fucked out of a lot of money, and it was time to move on, and that was it. And, you know, there was parts where I was like, it would kind of behoove a lot of these guys to kind of have that same kind of mindset that New Jack did, where it was nothing more, nothing less than a run in a promotion that, you know, for whatever reason, he's still asked about 13 years later.
I'm extremely glad that they got a hold of New Jack to interview, because often he
said what a lot of people danced around.
Yeah, yeah, that too. I mean, I also got the sense that he might have exaggerated what other people were dancing around. Like, he didn't just...
Those girls were in that hotel. They came up and they sucked dick.
Yeah. But he was great. He just offered... whereas I find, like, the other people were kind of very, I don't know, either... you know, normal to kind of happy to reflective to slightly sad to depressed. New Jack was just like New Jack. I mean, what better way to describe it?
And that's, you know, a lot of that is like this. To me, New Jack was like one of the greatest characters that they ever produced, in that you never knew where the person began and the character ended with this guy. And he always had this certain aura about him that... This guy will really fuck people up. You know what I mean? And that was something that, I mean, what wrestlers really have. And they created that with Taz as well during that time in ECW.
We're getting to New Jack. They go about as in depth as they could without actually showing the mass transit incident.
Which, yeah, with Eric Kulas.
Everybody, you know, most of you
have you watched that?
I've seen, like, GIFs. I've seen GIFs of it. And I haven't actually seen the whole video.
Is it online? I'm sure it is. But never watched it because I just don't want to watch it. I don't need that visual in my head.
Sure.
I get squeamish seeing.
We'll
John...
talk about what is the mass transit incident for people.
Well, for those not familiar, this was a show in the late 90s they had in, I think it was Revere, Massachusetts, and Axel Rotten was not on the show. He had, I think it was...
Apparently, he says, that they ask him why he wasn't on that show, and he says that he never received the plane ticket from Paul.
So there you go. He didn't go to the show. This 17-year-old indie wrestler who claimed he had been trained and such showed up stating he was 19 years old and old enough to get into the ring and pass whatever regulations they have. And
his name was Mass Transit.
Yeah, that was his gimmick name, Eric Kulas. And he ended up getting put into a tag match with Devon Dudley against New Jack. And I don't even know who
the gangsters.
Yeah, it would have been Mustafa and New Jack. And he went up to New Jack and asked him, he said, I've never bladed before. Can you cut me in the ring? And that's what New Jack did in the ring and cut him so terribly. He pull it, like it took, I've read like reports, it took the muscle off of like the bone, and it was just, he was leaking blood here, and went on to have tons of health problems. He ended up suing them, where he contradicted himself on a number of different stories, and ended up that New Jack got acquitted. And years later, Eric Koulos passed away, and you know,
from what?
He passed away from, I should look it up for the exact reasons, not, you know, stemming from that incident, but there was, you know, he said he endured countless pain and suffering over this, over this incident. And it was really interesting to see everyone's reaction to this Eric Koulos incident, where the reporters, who I classify as the most, you know, down to earth people, are just horrified. And this is the dark point of ECW history. Whereas a lot of wrestlers on this kind of justified it. Shane Douglas, the Blue Meanie.
Well, their justification was that this guy, you know,
he lied asked, about his age.
Well, he did that, and he also asked. I mean, you know, New Jack was when asked to do this, the guy, he's like, "Are you sure? Why don't you do it yourself?" And the guy insisted that New Jack cut him.
Well, you know what? No one is asking you to
cutting. I know cutting, blading. Anyway.
I mean, the industry at its most core is taking care of the person that you are working with.
Uh-huh.
That keyword with. Yeah. I mean, the same situation occurred with Steve Austin and Bret Hart at WrestleMania 13, where Austin asked Bret to cut him.
Mm-hmm.
And Bret Hart was a professional that night. And I just don't see any way you justify a man nearly killing somebody in the ring.
Well,
no matter what ignorance he showed in the back or what kind of attitude he had. But New Jack, he felt that, you know, this was his character. And look what this for what New Jack was trying to present as the New Jack character, this kind of incident is considered a positive in terms of, you know.
Anyway, New Jack does give his justification in the documentary. But, man, even without showing the incident, I felt like just to hear people describe it, just to hear New Jack talk about cutting the shit out of this guy, it was like, I don't know, it's kind of sent chills, man. It was pretty creepy. But yeah, quite in depth into the whole incident.
Eric Koulos died May the 12th, 2002, at the age of 22. Complications from gastric bypass surgery stemming from his weight problems, it says here. And of course, the Eric Koulos incident also led to them. They were close to getting on pay-per-view, and it led to a Request TV booting them off just when they saw this incident, and that there's no way we're putting you guys on, and it delayed their pay-per-view debut until that Barely Legal show in 97.
What else stood out about this film to you?
I mean, obviously the downfall of the company is really goes into a lot of depth towards that. A lot of focus on the Dudleys too, in terms of the promos that Bubba Ray cut, and if they were a turnoff.
Some amazing footage, I thought.
Holy shit!
Just like, you know, stuff that wasn't aired on TV of just people like Bubba Ray Dudley just cutting the most vicious promos. Shit, he'd never be allowed to say right now in any major company. But some great footage of that.
And you kind of see, you go to that incident a couple of months ago where Bully Ray was reprimanded for, you know, his...
Well, this was way worse.
Oh, it was. But
oh,
I'm
man,
saying, like...
This was him, like...
This is doing, what he felt a heel was.
This was him doing anything he can to try to goad a fan into taking a swing at him. Like, not even just playing around. This was like, I'm going to insult you. I'm going to insult your wife. I'm going to, you know, call you whatever name that I could think of.
It also, what did you think of when they had this great interview with Balls Mahoney, and it was April of 2001. So keep in mind, this was after ECW's final show in January and after Paul Heyman had already showed up on Raw in March of 2001. And Balls Mahoney is explaining to whoever was interviewing him here that they filed for Chapter 11 restructuring and still believed that ECW was going to continue, and they were just restructuring and just clinging. And there were a lot of guys who just, they had this blind faith that Paul Heyman will pull a rabbit out of his hat and he'll find that TV deal. He'll keep it going. And even after this guy is now on WWE every single week.
I think it goes to show just how much faith these guys had in Paul Heyman and in that company. And, you know, looking at that footage, how could you feel like, you know, it's anything but kind of sad? You know, here are these people kind of just, like, holding out for more rations. Meanwhile, like, you know, the king has already, you know, left or gone.
And whatever. You can certainly see how a lot of these guys would hold such resentment against Paul Heyman, in that here they were, a lot of guys owed a lot of money, and Heyman gets the gig with the WWE, moves onwards, mm-hmm. and I mean, for the most part, I mean, outside of where it's been, you know, prudent for Paul Heyman to embrace ECW, he's someone that has always said, you know, I don't really want to look back at any of this stuff. It's just a constant looking forward. And he's, you know, ECW is just part of his past, which is why I found it so interesting when, you know, his book was supposed to come out last year. And then with the WWE deal, that's kind of just been put on hold. I think it'd be really interesting to get into Paul Heyman's head and get an honest account of how he looks back at ECW. I mean, it's, yeah. You know, he's credited as a genius, and he's also credited as someone that you know, hurt a lot of people as well. I mean, there's no black and white to, you know, character portrayals of how people are viewed in history.
No. But I think, I don't know, even the people that he hurt, I feel like they, in some way, must feel like they owe something to this guy. Because, I mean, who would Balls Mahoney be without ECW and without what, yep, Paul Heyman created?
It's, certainly very interesting the way they, you know, Paul Heyman, I just felt, I didn't even feel it was a negative. He wasn't in this documentary. It was,
I thought it almost worked because, it worked better because here's like this mythical, you know, individual, almost like, you know, he was no longer around, you know, that everybody was kind of talking to him like, like a ghost, like John says in the interview. I thought it kind of made him like bigger than who he actually was.
Yeah, and if there was a comparison I had here, I recently I saw the GLOW documentary for the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, and in that documentary, the man who was behind it all, Dave McLean, he didn't grant them an interview. And to me, it was a real negative on that documentary because everyone's talking about him, and I really wanted to hear from him. In this documentary, I didn't take away the same feeling because I felt like you have so much out there in terms of perspective on Paul Heyman that, and they did have clips of him from back in the 90s, stuff that had, you know, people probably only those who were there live had seen at the time. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of interesting stuff. Todd Gordon, I thought, was great in that role as well, as someone who was behind the scenes and running this company alongside Heyman, who could add a lot. And they did, you know, like a 2.5-hour interview with with Todd Gordon. Was there anyone you felt was, you know, came off negatively or poorly to you, or you wanted more out of?
I definitely felt like, I mean, depending on how you look at it, New Jack, you could kind of take as somebody who's, I mean, but he is who he is. He's completely unapologetic about what he's done, about who he is. So you can either admire that, or you can think that was despicable. Who I wanted more out of?
I was disappointed with Shane Douglas. I found that he has so much that he could have shared, and it just, I don't know, he really just didn't add a whole lot to me in this.
Did they even really, like, talk with him?
He had a few on-camera comments, but it was mainly, I mean, he was focused a lot at the end of the show where they're looking at the Extreme Reunion show, the debacle, going to the hotel where Sabu was being stretchered out.
Yeah, I was surprised that most of the best clips in this didn't come from more of the notable stars. I mean, you know, they talked to Sandman, and outside of a few, you know, kind of funny Sandman lines, he didn't really have a whole lot to add to the overall narrative of the story. It was more so the people that you rarely hear from that I thought were really good.
Well, you also have to think to that of, you know, a lot of these guys who have never really got this kind of platform to chat about their experiences at length. I mean, someone like Sandman, watching, like, he comes off way better in the Forever Hardcore documentary because you felt he was much more engaged and, right. You know, so
I'm sure a lot of it maybe depended on, you know, what how much time they had with these people, what frame of mind they were in, what frame of, I don't know, mental health they were in at the time.
And it's wide and varying degrees.
Well, how about production-wise? Did you have any comments about, you know, the way this was edited? This was put together using the footage that they did, using the music that they had.
I thought the music was a nice touch. Adding to that, which is something that, you know, a lot of these, this really separated itself from your typical kind of, you know, like shoot style video where, I mean, low production values are kind of a cliche. And I think these guys made a cognizant effort to kind of step that up because
it was an Avatar. But I mean,
I'm not trying to say it was either.
For an independent Kickstarter-funded project something like this, I thought they did a great job. Primarily, like, looking for footage. Like, they went on some type of insane scavenger hunt looking for every last piece of non-WWE-owned ECW footage here. I thought they did a great job with that.
All right. So those are our thoughts on Barbed Wire City, and I guess we'll go into our interview right now with John Filipovich. It's a lengthy one, so sit back, check it out, and we've given our thoughts, so now we get to chat with John about the making of this documentary and a lot of interesting notes surrounding it. So here he is, John Filipovich, co-director of Barbed Wire City. All right, we have just concluded our review of Barbed Wire City, which is available now, and joining us right now, the co-director of the film, a man we got to meet down at WrestleCon earlier this month. He is John Filipovich of Barbed Wire City. And John, thanks a lot for popping on with us to chat a bit about the documentary. It's always fun for these kind of reviews to then kind of go beyond just what we've watched and kind of go behind the scenes with one of the creators. So thanks very much for joining us today.
I feel the same way. I like hearing stuff like that. And thanks for having me. Like, I loved meeting you guys at WrestleCon. And as I said, you know, privately to you, like, I've, you know, somewhat followed your career and I've listened to you. So it was, like, it's a treat for me to be on right now.
Well, I hope neither of us are a letdown for you, John. I hope
I'm not a letdown. I'm on the spot here.
No, man, it's all cool, all good to go here. This is such an interesting one for you because you go all the way back to 2000, which is like in wrestling, that's like two lifetimes ago. I'm just curious, kind of where the initial idea came from of what was the end goal with this back in 2000, and you look at so much that's happened in 13 years surrounding this ECW brand. What was the original idea that you guys wanted to do with this back when the promotion was still running shows?
I think we were younger and we were doing mockumentaries, and it seemed like a reasonable jump to do like a real documentary. And I proposed, I was a fan of ECW. At the time, and I proposed it to Kevin Kiernan, who is not a wrestling fan. And the original idea, that's the one thing is that, I've learned this through this experience, but now I get to talk to other documentary filmmakers, and you realize whatever your initial idea is, or whatever you think it's going to be when you're done with it, or what you envision, it never is. And that's a good thing, you know what I mean? Because if you're really stuck on one idea, and you're not changing it, like, 10, 20 to, 50 times, even in the editing room at the last minute, you're really kind of doing a disservice to like what you're doing. You're not kind of growing. So like the original idea with all that, preamble, the original idea was I would have been so unhappy if this was what happened. I wanted to document the culture of the ECW arena. It was still a subculture thing. Like that grain, found its way all the way to the finished product. But I wanted to document the culture outside of the arena on show day, and maybe even some of it in there. And I wanted a little bit of history, like background on this building, because I just thought it was this really neat place. It was kind of like, it's on the outskirts of South Philly. It's kind of this bubble, and I felt like, it's this, hidden kind of Fight Club-like world. Where I'm like, do the people who live around it even know what's going on in that building? So I wanted to do something with that, and that was the original idea. Now it changed like I said, 50 times between now and then. But that was the original idea. It would have been like 30 minutes. It would have been a lot fluffier, So.
It's interesting because, you fast forward to that early period of 2001 where really the entire wrestling world in North America was completely shaken up with WCW and ECW going out of business. At that point, and I think that's one of the strengths of this documentary is that you have the benefit of a lot of perspective now. I think it would have been, a missed opportunity had you guys just gotten this out there mid-2001, the promotion went out of business. Instead, you've had that time to really look at the impact that ECW has had and its staying power in comparison to WCW at the time. I mean, this is a promotion that it served its audience, and this audience really did live through a lot of these performers, and that certainly comes through.
Yeah, well, I think within, like, the wrestling market, like, something like that, you know, you could definitely take that away. Like, for me, it was more like, you know, filmmaking and documentary, like, the focus was on the fact that we realized last year we had the chance to talk about the ramifications of all of this, to talk about the human stories, to talk about things that were more kind of accessible to anybody who likes niche, you know, culture stuff or misunderstood, you know, forms of entertainment, you know, and I'm saying you know a lot. I just realized that in the last 2 days, I say you know a lot. So anyway, your point stands, like the business constricted. But I think the thing that I really focus on more is like the underdog business story, the holistic approach of, like, the synergistic approach, really, of the fans, the staff, and the wrestlers, you know, all kind of coming together and, like, believing in this sense of this cause, you know, and the way that it kind of tragically, you know, falls off, you know, and then what happens, you know, years later as people are entering their 40s and even closer to their 50s in some of these guys' cases, and what's become of them.
Can you just talk about how you went about, you know, collecting all your interviews, because they seem to span quite a distance of time between, you know, the years 2000 and up till the present day?
I think the first interview we shot was March of 2000. In fact, I know it was, you know, and that's not even in the film. I think the last thing that we shot, you don't see him in it, but the first thing you hear is actually a famous photographer named George Napolitano, and that was shot like February 23rd of this year. We just snuck that one little thing in there. So yeah, you're talking about a great distance of time. It's pretty much 13 years. It really didn't break for us until we got Todd Gordon, who was the original founder of what was then Eastern Championship Wrestling. And I bugged Todd, for like 6 months. I bothered him, and he finally sat for us. And I prepped for a whole month once he agreed. And he sat for us for 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And his wife was calling. She's like, "Where are you?" You know, he had closed up his shop in Center City, Philly, his business that he runs. And that really helped because, you know, the credibility of having gotten him, him calling other people and saying, "Hey, you should talk to these guys." And then some of the things he said in the interviews where he knocked certain people, I only thought it was fair to get a balanced story and go find those people and talk to them. And that opened up other avenues, too.
So would it be safe to say, John, that there were, I'm sure, lots of guys that you spoke to who were more than happy to sit down, and you really do get the sense a lot of these guys, I mean, that was the high point of their careers, and some of them, I think, just forever searching to kind of rekindle that magic they had in ECW. And then on the other side, did you encounter a lot of guys who simply did not want to or showed a lot of resistance when it came to sitting down and wanting to discuss the promotion that was?
Well, not just the high point of their careers. I got the distinct impression, especially in the final product when you really look at the film, of their lives.
Yeah.
Some of the people in here in this film, and there's like a lot of, like, we don't have narration, you know, there are I think 46 voices in this thing. You know, I did over 60 interviews total, and I think we talked to probably 100 people overall. I got a sense that some of these guys, this is the football player talking about the state championship at the local bar in their 40s. You get a wide swath of different people who some moved on, some didn't, you know. Lou DeAngelis in our film, and he's a success story, man. I mean, Lou played a reasonably small part within the Dudleys and then was a manager as Louie Dangerously at the end. And Lou moved into promotions. He worked for Comcast, WWE, and now he's Cirque du Soleil.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing pretty well. Stevie kind of has a Michael Manna, who plays Stevie Richards, kind of has a life outside of wrestling now while still wrestling. But yeah, there were some guys, they just, they're so, especially we lucked out in a sense that the company did close because we were quote unquote on the ground kind of reporting slash filming, you know, as this was going on, and we gave, you know, people a chance to talk about how they felt as things were dissolving, how they were feeling, like how they were dealing with that and how they felt about it in that moment. You know what I mean? And then again, years later when they had, there was a breath of time. So those people were more than willing to talk. Yeah. But other people, you know, you chase forever and sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't. I mean, it's funny. Like I said, Todd Gordon was our first interview, and this the person I'm about to mention isn't a wrestler. It was actually Dave Shear of now he's of PWInsider.com. Mm-hmm. Todd called him the moment the interview ended, and kind of gave a seal of approval. He gave me an email address and he gave me a phone number. And Dave Shear, like, he really blew me off for like a year here and there, and then said like, oh, I don't think that, you know, who cares about this now, kind of a thing. And then he ended up doing an interview with me, and I think it was July 4th weekend of last year. So, and then some people you just, you dance around and you think you get them, and you, we didn't end up getting them. You know what I mean? We talked to Tommy Dreamer for years, on and off. He was always a really great guy. He was always under contract to some place, and then when he wasn't, we weren't doing the project at the time. And then last year we thought we were going to have him. And it looked really good, and he would have. I thought he would have added a lot to certain segments, and it just it didn't end up happening, you know.
And it seems that, you know, obviously Paul Heyman. I was kind of torn on this because it's like you look at this documentary, and it's like, you know, it would have been great to have Paul, and yet by the end of this, John, it was like to me he was the main character of this documentary, and at the end of it, I never felt like this was something that lacked any Paul Heyman. I thought some of the stuff that you guys got from the mid-90s was very fascinating to hear from him at those fan Q&As, everyone having, you know, a wide range of opinions about Paul Heyman. Was there dialogue with Paul Heyman at any point? Because it seems that when it has obviously served him with the reboot of ECW, he has embraced it. But outside of that, I mean, ECW is really, you know, a closed book to him in many senses.
He's very smart with the way he handles, you know, things publicly. I thank you, first of all, for the compliment. That's pretty much generally 95% of the feedback I get as far as dealing with Paul Heyman is, you guys did a great job with the ghost of him kind of hanging over it. You know, he's a central character, and even though he didn't sit for you, you gave a really balanced portrait of him. So I, you know, if enough people say that, I feel it's genuine. So I'm like, good, you know, I guess we nailed that one. We reached out to him through so much in the early days. And you know what? He was under WWE contract, so I don't know that he ever would have been able to talk to us. But especially in the early days, it was just like, let's just do an interview. And I don't want to name the names, but people that, you know, appeared in our film, and some that didn't, that know him pretty well, had reached out to him and vouched for us. And I had his email address, and I wrote him a letter. I got his home phone number, and I called that. The only dialogue I had was in 2006 or 2007. At some point, I was thinking of, you know, restarting again, and a journalist talked to him. He was kind of interested. We were connected. We had a short email exchange, and it didn't really go anywhere. Hmm. And at that point, so you're talking like 6-7 years ago, at that point, I was like, okay, well, I'm completely prepared. You know, I'm going to prepare for him not being involved.
Yes. You know, as far as you're aware, he probably hasn't seen the documentary yet.
I don't know for sure. I know people around him have it. Mm-hmm. So I would imagine that if he hasn't, he has access to it, like, now. You know what I mean? Right. I don't know that I'll ever, you know, hear one way or the other how he felt about it. I would be interested to hear. I'd be interested to have, like, an off-the-record conversation with the guy. Obviously, I've studied him off and on for 13 years doing this, but even before that, as a fan, I watched and kind of took in what was going on. I'm also not kind of, I didn't make this to seek the approval of Paul Heyman. You know, I want, the nicest thing he could say is, I thought you were very fair to me. You know, I think that would be cool.
In the time that you've been working on this, I mean, obviously the very successful WWE DVD was released, as well as that Jeremy Borash Forever Hardcore documentary. you must have seen at least one of or both of these films. I wanted to know your thoughts on that, and how did those releases kind of affect your storytelling in this movie?
When it happened, I was crushed because we weren't anywhere near an avenue to finish it or get it out there properly. And then Rise and Fall came out, and I was like, oh, you know, as an old fan, I appreciated it, but you know, I wasn't making the documentary as a fan. You know, I was making it, you know, very early on. I kind of took the fan hat off and, you know, tried to look at things journalistically and get the best, most human story possible. They did affect it in the sense that it gave us license, thankfully, which makes Kevin Kiernan very happy, the co-director. We said, okay, well, we're not going to cover any character profiles of wrestling characters. We're not going to cover any storyline stuff unless it's relevant to the real world. And the focus of this will be on being an unbiased, true documentary, and not something that comes out of, you know, the wrestling world, so to speak. We had the chance to be completely independent and not have any, you know, because some people have said to me that work inside the industry, they're like, I wish I could have done what you guys got to do, but there would be problems if I presented things like that. And I didn't have those problems because, like, I'm not really in the wrestling industry. I follow it to some degree. Kevin doesn't really at all. So, I mean, I can just walk away and there aren't any, like, serious ramifications where it's, like, my job. Like, if I'm a reporter, like, we present reporters in there, there's only so far that they can say things, you know.
I found that the reporters, you know, just from, you know, you know, me and Wei putting stuff together as well. It seems that, you know, you're able to kind of illustrate with a lot better perspective here with reporters where you kind of, with one step removed, so to speak, that rather than under the spotlight where a lot of these guys, I mean, the reporters to me have a lot better perspective of what actually went back at what happened at the time versus kind of a romanticized view when you were kind of there in the forefront of it all. Tell us a little bit about balancing that of the performers as well as the reporters when it came to kind of threading a historical account together.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's a lot of things that go into that. First of all, as somebody who had followed the wrestling industry in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was like, you know, I love documentaries, and documentaries about bands, like, say, in the 70s, they'll be like, okay, well, it'll trot out, like, you know, two or three people who covered those bands for perspective. You'll get somebody from Rolling Stone or some other, you know, modern or old magazine that was a reporter that was following it that can give you some perspective and context. Which kind of dovetails into the next thing I'm going to say, which is wrestlers are great because they're part of the story. I'll address one thing is that, like, there are people that get back to me and they're like, why didn't you have such and such in it? You know, why didn't you have, you know, this guy? Because he was a star. And it's like, well, I reached out to everybody. But I don't think that, I always use this comparison. Like, we have Scott Levy in our film. He goes, but you know, the character Raven. Raven was a big deal in ECW at certain points. I don't think that Scott Levy's story is any more important or more valid than, say, Angel Medina, who has some really cool quotes in our film that really show the human side of what things were going on. I also don't think, like, you know, I've got to make the best film possible. And making kind of wrestling world judgments as far as, like, this guy was more popular or his boss, you know, had enough confidence to put him at the end of the show. I don't think that's a really good idea for me to judge whose perspective is more important. And it really came down to the quotes. And one thing that wrestlers had trouble with was thinking outside of themselves or giving you perspective. And a lot of the things in this film, again, we don't cover storylines and angles. So there's a lot of business stuff and a lot of real-world perspective of what's going on with the company that wrestlers don't really have an opinion. They might have an opinion on it, but they don't have a big perspective on it. They kind of know what they did, you know, because it's a very self-involved business.
Sure.
So for certain things, it became a necessity to have these reporters, and I already wanted them, and the best thing to do was to balance it. The best thing to do, you know, because the torch has a certain way that they come, a certain angle that they come from. PW Insider, those guys are unique because they were fans who then got into wrestling journalism. So they're coming from a certain perspective, too. You know, Dave Meltzer's kind of the dean of wrestling journalism, you know, so I wanted to have him included. And I also got, you know, Jason Powell, who at the time that I interviewed him was working for The Torch. He also works for ProWrestling.net. But everybody of those journalists dealt with Paul Heyman and ECW, maybe not on a daily basis, but they had his phone number and they talked to him and they had some perspective on everything. So I thought it was important because these guys probably were talking to Paul even more than some of the wrestlers, quite frankly, because ECW only ran, you know, two nights out of a week, if that at times, you know what I mean? So, and the interactions would have been different because you're talking to your boss and he's trying to sell you on how you should be presented and everything and maybe avoiding some questions that he wouldn't, or not being asked certain questions that he would be by a journalist. So I felt there was kind of a necessity to present these guys, but also balance, just like the wrestlers. We have, you know, there's wrestlers in there that are like, Paul Heyman's the worst person in the world.
Yeah.
And then there'll be another guy who says, you know what, I really appreciate what he did. You know, especially when we went to the reunion, guys didn't really talk bad about Paul anymore like they did, you know, 11 years before. And that's because I think they maybe subconsciously, maybe consciously realize, I'm getting paid to do what I still love to do 11, 12 years after the fact because of, you know, this man made me some sort of commodity.
And that's really interesting because, you know, you make it's very hard for me when I look back at that time not to make the obvious comparisons to WCW that, I mean, though it was on a bigger platform at the time and made much more money than ECW ever did, we look today and there's no real nostalgia for that brand. You don't see reunion shows. You don't see someone like a Lash LaRue that's been able to get a life on the independent scene because of his time in WCW. It was an incredible job when it came to branding these guys as ECW and a certain almost gimmick to their post ECW careers that have allowed them to continue to this day to get bookings based on stuff that happened 15, 20 years ago.
It was the cause. People still believe to certain degrees in quote unquote the revolution, you know, and what exactly the revolution is up for conjecture. You know what I mean? You ask 15 people who are involved with the company and you'll get, you know, probably 8 to 10 different answers, you know, but I think that their fan base or people that remember it fondly, especially now that, you know, with hindsight and with it closing, there's this, you know, romanticism about what ECW was.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the goals of the movie, you know, was like, let's demystify that. And that doesn't mean let's find a way to trash it. It means what really went on here. And it was a lot of smoke and mirrors, and it was brilliant in a lot of ways. I always say, ECW was this brilliant cultural thought experiment by Paul Heyman that ended up getting so big and out of control that he couldn't quite contain it, and maybe he didn't pull back enough. And this thought experiment, it just goes awry in the end. You know what I mean? But it's, the thought experiment isn't just let's do violent things. It's, you know, the way that he presented the interviews, the promos, where he presented them, the size of the guys, the athleticism of the guys, the people that he would introduce the world to. I mean, he's a guy who came out of the territorial system. He was this young guy who had been around the business since he was a child, practically, who had all these new ideas, and all these old guys were like, no, they didn't want to deal with him. He got fired from WCW for being opinionated and a loudmouth, and WWE didn't pick him up, although there were talks of that. And he finds a guy in Philadelphia through you know, his best friend at the time, Eddie Gilbert. He ends up, you know, getting in that spot, and he begins kind of this grand experiment, and for a while it goes really well, and then it sort of goes off the rails for a number of reasons, you know, financial and otherwise. It is kind of a tragedy, but it's a great story, and I don't think that because ECW quote-unquote failed, I mean, different people use different metrics, and, you know, I know I'm getting a little off base here, so I'll rein it in, but I think it's wrong to say that ECW was a failure because it went out of business, because eventually everything goes out of business. Eventually I'm going to be dead, you know what I mean? Things come in and they come out. ECW is like this supernova shooting across the sky, and it explodes and it disperses in different ways. And I think that's valid. I mean, the story of what they did, even though they didn't reach what they thought they would, I don't know that it ever would have happened. You know, it's a, kind of like a weird goal, like, let's get on pay-per-view, let's get on national TV. Well, you're really becoming kind of mainstream then. And even if people, you know, pop culture accepted that the gratuitous violence or the cursing or the attitude or the edginess of it, it would have had trouble succeeding, cause, which is kind of illustrated in the film, because it was such a niche thing. It was special because it was small. It was special because the fans could bond together. And as that kind of evolved and changed, again, it kind of just dispersed. It couldn't contain itself.
Looking at specifically the point in the documentary where you guys cover the deal with TNN at the time, coming on in August of 1999, and it's always so interesting to look at just the timing of all of these deals, and then you look at just a few years later when, you know, TNN rebranded as Spike TV. 2 years after that, they bring in TNA, and you just think of all these kind of what if scenarios that, you know, had this. I mean, if TNA were to go out of business tomorrow, I don't think they'd be given the rap of, oh, this was just a company that didn't know how to be deal business wise and have lost tons more than ECW ever did during its entire run at that time. And you just look at all these little moving factors of what if had ECW and Spike TV aligned at the same time and kind of the cross sections at that point in time, it's really interesting to look back at and what that television deal ultimately was, you know, an anchor to the promotion rather than, you know, the thing that was going to propel them to that next level.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many interesting what if scenarios. And that comes up a lot when, like, I do these interviews. It's a crazy rabbit hole to go down because, well, Heyman would have had to have evolved, which it's very possible, as far as he would have had to pull back. Because by the end there, he had lost a lot of talented guys. He had a newer fan base that was coming in that was kind of looking for that violence. I mean, I've seen, obviously, we have, you know, the RF, you know, the house show footage. And TNN, actually, pretty much RF was allowed to film anything that wasn't a pay-per-view or the arena. And that's the footage that we used. I watched a lot of those because I had to cut it up for B-roll. There are a lot of fans who just didn't accept the wrestling towards the end because they were newer people who came to see the spectacle. And a big part of the spectacle was, you know, the escalation of the violence, which isn't to say wholesale that nobody cared, you know, and to negatively paint the fan base. But had it kept going, Heyman would have had to evolve. And that means probably losing the people who are coming for the spectacle, but drawing in the people who are already like, I don't feel safe going to that show, or I don't, you know, or unfairly saying, well, they don't have any wrestling or something. Now, on the plus side, the people that came out of that wrestling boom, if you think about it, there's a huge boom in America for wrestling in the late 90s. A lot of guys go and get trained. Those guys end up in places like ROH and TNA. A lot of them grew up being ECW fans. And Heyman saw something in Punk in 2005. He would have absolutely seen something in him in 2002. He would have, you know, the trajectory of Samoa Joe's career could be very different. There's a lot of, you know, what ifs, because he would have had this younger talent. There was a glut of it that came out of that boom. More people got trained, you know, so, you know, you just had a lot more bodies, and so by percentage, more were going to be talented. So he had that going for him, but I do think he would have evolved. It would have been interesting to see economically if it was feasible to change the direction of the company, as far as, like, people, you know, following it. And the TV deals are important because he never was going to have, you know, you talked about TNA. That's an anomaly for a company to, like, Panda Energy to just go, yeah, we'll just keep going. We'll fund this. You know, it's this guy's daughter. Yeah, just whatever. We'll kind of write it off. Let's see what we can do with it, you know. That's a huge anomaly. I don't think that Heyman was going to find this person to just give him. He certainly tried at the end there. And we have a story in the film where he approached, you know, Billy Corgan about investing.
You talk about grabbing your footage from RF, and I didn't know about that, that they were able to shoot all those house shows. I was incredibly impressed at how you were able to acquire all this footage about basically a product that only one company has the rights to, and so far nobody outside of that company has done it. So can you just talk a little bit about grabbing the photos that you did, grabbing that footage that you did? Because at no point watching this unauthorized documentary did I really feel like you know, I don't see what's going on here. It really felt like something almost official.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, it helps that I had followed the wrestling business and I lived in the Northeast. I kind of lived through this. I kind of knew the players, and I had met them when I was young by doing the documentary. So even when we came back to this, I still knew the people to talk to. And we were always on the lookout. You know, we got photos from a lot of different sources, and that wasn't always easy. I spent a day down at Kappa Publishing, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, in negotiating the photos that I wanted, because they don't have a bin. You know, like, I wanted photos of John Bailey, because there was no video of the Straw Hat guy, except for that. There's only one existing fan cam from the arena, which we definitely used what we could out of it. And that was, they allowed them to tape Sandman's return in 99. So there is genuine ECW arena footage in it, but that's the only thing. And it really didn't show John Bailey, who was, you know, kind of a signature fan. And a big thing for us was, you know, other people will pay lip service to the fans of ECW, but we thought it was important, if you're going to make a documentary, that you want to play outside of, like, the hardcorest of wrestling fans. You have to put a human face on them. So we went and we interviewed John Bailey, or we interviewed Tony Lewis from New York. Finding pictures of John Bailey is difficult, because you go to PWI and you go, hey, Stu Sachs, I need photos of this guy. And he goes, well, I don't have a bin of, you know, random fan photos to look through things. So it becomes a scavenger hunt. A lot of stuff became a scavenger hunt, you know, to find the proper things. And then the other thing is that they had a deal. I really wanted, at the end of the film, a photo of Paul Heyman holding a WWE microphone. And I found one. And I was like, this is great. And I show it to Stu, and he goes, yeah. And then as I'm walking away, he goes, oh, you can't use that. I said, what do you mean? He goes, anything from this date on that we had to deal with WWE, we can't license it, you know. But anything before that, I'm like, well, everything before that is not Paul Heyman in WWE, you know. Which is where the torches and the lariats came in as visuals, you know, kind of newspaper headlines. So it was a scavenger hunt. It was difficult, you know, to find all these little pieces. And then you would luck out, though. You would get that footage of the pay-per-view. Obviously, the pay-per-view, we can't use that footage. But we had footage shot by a fan outside the arena that day, which is really rare footage that not a lot of people have seen. And that guy just contacted me.
That's incredible. And
we, you know, we talked, and he was just happy to be involved, and it was, you know, he's a good guy, you know. And we were able to use that, and it really enhanced that segment. And then the other thing was, we tried to be authentic whenever we could, which is why during the pay-per-view segment, every one of those photos is from the night of the pay-per-view. There was no fakery there. The only small fakery was the Joey Styles story where Mike Johnson's talking about, like, the mic cutting out and everything. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's from the ECW arena, but it's from the night that the Sandman came back, because we didn't have the pay-per-view footage. Honestly, though, you know, to wrap this up, there are only four or five times during the entire editing process where I went, man, right here would be good to have, you know, this or this. Like the section where we, you know, Tommy Dreamer was very emblematic, especially in the early days, of a guy who was willing to go really far for the quote-unquote cause. And we wanted to try to get to him as this kind of symbol of that. And we had some really neat RF footage of it, but would have been cool to have the choke slams off of the, you know, in the ECW arena that are just nuts if you've ever seen them. Brian Lee choke slamming him off of two different parts of the building, but it's TV footage, so we couldn't, you know what I mean? So three or four little things like that, like I said. Otherwise, super happy with all the ECW footage, and they're super happy with all the visuals in there. And I really thought, you know, the music brought it all together.
Was there ever, did you guys have the rights to air the Eric Koulos incident? Was that ever discussed, of actually putting that in there during the discussion about that?
Okay, well, glad you brought that up, because a few people have said, it's not as impactful without the footage. And here's the story on that. I did try. When I had my first meeting with RF, one of the things he said is, that's the only thing that I won't license to you. Said okay, walked away for a while. We started requesting things, and, you know, it's funny, I did a lot of research on this. So I would find out that there were incidents at shows, and I would request the fan cam of it, and then it wouldn't be sent to me. So we had a, what I like to term the beating of the bushes meeting, where I beat the bushes and wanted to know, why don't I have these things? So I go, such and such a date. He goes, it doesn't exist anymore. ECW confiscated the tape. Okay, you know. Or the other thing was there would be things cut out of tapes, like not recently, but like when they happened.
Uh-huh.
So I said, okay, you know. So, you know, it was kind of a scavenger hunt to find things, because there's some crazy, you know, there's a lot of crazy Dudley's footage in there from that kind of, you know, examining what they were doing and whether it was good or bad, you know, for business and the atmosphere that it created within these ECW shows. But there are also some crazy Dudley's things that just the tape, you know, depending on who you believe, it just doesn't exist, and regardless, it's not going to be given to me. So the coolest thing came up. I said again, you know, we'd like to, because we had had a meeting, Kevin and I, where we said, you know, I don't even feel comfortable showing a lot of the more graphic parts of that. I just think it's gratuitous, it's unnecessary. So we wanted to get, like, two shots. We wanted video of maybe, you know, a shot to establish, you know, a face, a human face to it, which is always important. And we wanted maybe one of the EMTs with the blood-soaked rag pressing against his head, so you wouldn't see the blood spurting out. Because if you've ever seen that video, it's disgusting. I made another pass at RF about it, and it was explained to me that after Eric Kulis passed away, a few years later, that the family had sued for pain and suffering or something like that for the release of the tape. There was a settlement that was paid out, and this is, you know, years after the fact.
Right.
I tried a workaround. The workaround is I was aware from research that there were a Providence, Rhode Island local news channel had done two stories, which also included less graphic parts of the tape. I wanted to license those. And the same in Boston. For whatever reason, the newscast wouldn't. The company that owns the newscast just said we don't license the old footage. You know, even 15 seconds. So at that point, it's dead. And then it becomes, you know, do you want to scavenger for a photo of the guy? Do you want to go after, you know, try to find his father? And we made really preliminary looking into talking to the father. And I was told by some people that, you know, he had dealt with years before, that he really didn't want to be bothered with the whole thing. And then it became this, you know, that combined with the lawsuit with RF, it became this weird hornet's nest where you want this human face to illustrate this. But is it worth it? The problems just kept cropping up with it. So we went with what we went with, you know.
It's interesting because obviously you get New Jack's take on that. And, yeah, for those that have seen the Eric Kulas incident, it's one of the most horrific clips you will ever see in any kind of wrestling environment.
And the wrestlers didn't break ranks on that, too. If you watch it, I mean, in that segment, they are all pretty consistent with the way that they emotionally dealt with it was kind of the us against them thing again. The stories are very consistent, which is why in the film we had to go to the journalists to get a reaction, a kind of a negative reaction. Because in the film, even the people that I like, that I'm friendly with, were like, well, the kid lied. You know, it's not really, you know, I'm like, well, isn't it New Jack's fault? I mean, he asked him to blade him. A lot of people get bladed, and that doesn't happen. It was, you know, was it irresponsible? And they just didn't want to address it on those terms, you know? It was difficult. Even years later, it's kind of, you know, it's not like they all get together and still talk about, you know, we have to keep this pact to talk about it this way. Just independently, over the years, this is the way the people involved felt.
I was amazed at the way that just the justification that was made for this, and it's
very callous, in my opinion.
Absolutely,
I still,
it is.
To this day, I shiver when he. Can I? Is there a language barrier on this?
No, not at all.
Okay. Oh, when to this day, and I've seen it a million times, obviously, when he says, you know, I got in the ring, and this is Jerome Young talking, New Jack. I got in the ring, I poked him twice, and he wasn't bleeding, so I cut the shit out of him. I still get, like, a chill through my body when I see that. Now, other people, it's interesting, other people react differently to that. When you get, like, an ECW fan base, like, at the premiere of this, with a lot of old hardcore ECW fans, that's that there were people in the arena that night that laughed when he said that, you know, which I was semi-prepared for, but it still kind of shocked me, you know what I mean? Like, and obviously New Jack is New Jack, and he's kind of this, you know, quasi-shoot-tape character, even when he's being, you know, Jerome, that's who Jerome Young is at this point, you know, but... And I realized earlier in the movie there is, you know, some he says some humorous things when they talk about living like rock stars. But I was very, it's very surprising, you know, the realities of that. And, you know, if we would have had the tape, maybe it would have been different. I don't know. I mean, some people just don't want to deal with that kind of stuff, you know, emotionally.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. When you guys had the premiere a couple of weeks back, what kind of was the audience makeup? Did you find that, have you spoken to a lot of people that were maybe are more kind of on Kevin's side where they don't follow wrestling as much and kind of how they viewed this very interesting promotion in ECW and kind of how some of the performers come across? I'm kind of curious of kind of the non-fans' reaction to this.
Yeah, well, that's the most interesting to me. Not to be dismissive of the wrestling fans, but we're definitely very interested in getting this into, like, documentary-centric film festivals and kind of people who are interested in niche culture. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that I'm interested in, and we tried to make it as accessible as possible. For that reason. And at the premiere, it was like I'd say 70-30. 70% were like wrestling fans, and then 30% came because they had some affiliation to Kevin and I, but nobody had seen the film. And I'm talking like my sister, you know, like old friends, you know, just people who just came to be supportive. Their opinions were really interesting just because they were shocked that this existed. Like, this is the thing, in the wrestling bubble, it's like everybody knows the story of ECW. Like, I always love, you know, the reviews are like, you're not going to learn anything new, which isn't quite true, but it's like, okay, well, if you're that obsessive that you're like that, like, maybe that's true, okay. That wasn't our goal. It wasn't a informational historical piece, even though there's a lot of information in it. But it is interesting the way, like, outside of that bubble, people don't know. I mean, I always say, like, the people that I'm friends with and most people I'm friends with in real life are not wrestling fans. They know Hulk Hogan, they know Stone Cold, they know The Rock because he's also a movie star. They're aware Vince McMahon exists and kind of Ric Flair. And a lot of them are too old to really have paid any attention to John Cena, even though he's kind of a mainstream star too. Those people were, like, shocked that this existed. They were very taken in emotionally. There was a guy, an actor named Tyler Mane. I'm so sorry because this guy was so nice to me. He played Sabretooth in the X-Men. Mm-hmm. And he showed up at the premiere and he brought his wife. And his wife talked my ear off, and in a good way, you know. I was right there with her, you know, asking her questions. She was very struck by how emotional she got about the story. About kind of, you know, the tragic parts of it and the ups and downs and the swing of things. She really got into, like, the subtext of it. This is a movie that definitely viewed differently by different people. I mean, another thing that happened at the premiere was the credits rolled, we got a big ovation, and then there was, not everybody, but there was an ECW chant, which I'm not saying is wrong at all, you know what I mean? I mean, because to those people, what they took out of it was, this was this, you know, depiction that they really liked of, you know, maybe this promotion that they either lived through or that their brother had lived through and that was somehow a part of their life. And then there's other people that were like, what a tragedy that is. You know, what a sad story. Which is, to me, when I hear people say that, I go, yeah, that's a legitimate emotion to feel from walking away from this movie. And I think tragedies can be very compelling, you know. And it's not all tragic, but it's interesting, like, the diverse opinions based on what your base of knowledge is, because wrestling fans just kind of accept that this, not that it existed, but that the things that happened, you know, when you see all the chair shots in this, like, I kind of flinch, even though I've been a lifelong wrestling fan, because I'm looking at it outside of that. But I think a lot of people, they're just like, well, that's what happened, you know, like, that's normal to them. It's not normal to people outside of that world, though, because they didn't view it all the time. Which is, you know, to wrap up, it's like, that's why it was so important to have Billy Corgan in the film. because he proves that this happened in the real world, that this existed in a way, you know what I mean? Otherwise, it's almost on this other planet, you know, that this promotion exists. And not that they were always so violent and everything, but not everybody knew about them.
Yeah, and that's it's a bit of a deeper point here, but I just got finished reading Hardcore Holly's book that he came out with, and he talks about, you know, people that he was very close with at times, including Chris Benoit and Crash Holly, and just kind of just flat out saying that, you know, these things would happen, and you just put them to the back of your brain, and later in your life, maybe you have to deal with these losses, and you just move forward. And I think that the wrestling fan, the ardent wrestling fan, does a lot of that as well, where you look at, you know, just with ECW alone, that this left a body count behind as well, and that, you know, it's the next wrestling show has to go on, and you just kind of come to terms with it internally so that you can still remain, your fandom is still there, and moving past a lot of this and still cheering when you see a chair shot or you see a present day Balls Mahoney and Axel Rotten, which to me was two of the most powerful interviews in this entire documentary. And I think that if you were a hardcore ECW fan or someone that has never watched wrestling in your life, you're leaving those two characters with completely different opinions of, I would assume.
Yeah, I would totally agree. That's the thing that was, it's funny, for some reason I thought the most talked about people might be, and it's not that people aren't talking about them, but I thought that Johnny Grunge and Ted Petty would jump off the screen to people, and I thought that Tony Lewis also would. And people have all mentioned that to me, especially, you know, Tony Lewis's involvement, the super fan from New York who helped them get back on pay-per-view. But really, the overwhelming feedback I'm getting is the Balls and Axel stuff, especially, you know, because, you know, like Brian Knighton, who played Axel Rotten, in his 2001 interview was just so... It's another thing where a guy walked up to me that was like, I think he's like Kevin's uncle. I'm not sure. He was at the after party. And he starts talking, and he was like, Brian and John were really interesting. And I'm like, Brian and John. I'm like, oh, okay, Axel and Balls, okay. And he said, I was very impressed with this, Brian Knighton, because he said why he did what he did, and he made the point of, like, you know, I do all these violent things, and I do them for the people. I do them for that instant, you know, reaction, because I think I should give them a little more. And he made the point of saying, like, we're not all these monsters or something to the effect that chew on raw meat or something like that. And there's this interesting, like, it kind of flows through the whole film where you see him in, like, 97 in file footage from a convention. He shows the scars. He says, look at me. If anybody's made a commitment to this, you know, this thing, it's me. And then he points to Sabu and he says, oh, look at us. You got to ask yourself, you know, how far you're willing to go, and we're all in. You see him in 2001. He shows the scars. I say, why'd you do that? He says, stupidest thing I ever did. You see him in 2012, and he's like, you know, check out these scars. It's awesome. Best time of my life. That's interesting on a human level to me. There's a subtext to that. Same with Balls Mahoney. Like, these guys really saw themselves as these, like, fringe entertainers, and they got instant gratification off of it. And it just, they became drunk off of it. They needed it. Like, if you're George Clooney, you shoot a scene two or three times, and maybe when you walk off the set, the director pats him on the back, waves and goes, good job, George, I think you nailed that one. And then you go about your business elsewhere, and then maybe 8 months from now, you read a review. When you're a wrestler, like, Balls Mahoney talks about flaming tables. And he says, like, I was burned, I didn't care, yeah, flaming tables. And he says, it was great, the crowd was going, wah! That's an instant reaction, an instant form of gratification that he's getting. It's like a drug. You know, so they, you know, kind of conflated that drug with what that they owed the people and what gave them value. You know what I mean? Like, Axel does talk in the film about getting pigeonholed. The problem is he didn't work to get out of that in any way, and maybe he couldn't have. Maybe for a while he was convinced that that's who he was. You know, it's sad in a lot of ways, you know what I mean? But I think it's exceedingly interesting on a human level, and that's why, you know, the way we presented it without trying to really guide you how to feel about it, because that one scene where Axel jumps in while Balls is talking, when we juxtaposition it with the violent things that they did that night at the very, you know, a bloody, violent match during that reunion, You can take that as a very sweet moment, or you can take that as somehow very sad. Or you could feel both. You know, it's kind of up to you, but I think it's a very interesting telling moment about these people and how they feel about their lives at that, you know, in their early 40s now, having gone through all of this.
Throughout the movie, you would key the wrestlers under their real names, and quotations would be their kayfabe names. And I noticed even throughout this interview itself, you referred to these people as by their real names. And why was that important for you to do that?
Because if you're just looking at it, how can I say this? If you're just looking at it as they're wrestlers, and this is Raven, it's simply a wrestling product. You're dehumanizing them in some way. Maybe dehumanizing isn't the proper word. It is a little dramatic, I realize. You're looking at them as just this pretend performer. You're allowing them to kind of hide behind that in some senses. And maybe they don't want to, or maybe they do. I don't, you know, it's probably different people feel differently. I didn't want to talk to Axel Rotten, you know, and have this whole, you know, image of that. I wanted to talk to Brian Knighton and see how he felt about things. I think it's a little silly if you're making a real documentary that isn't specifically for wrestling fans. And honestly, if you're doing that, then just show angles and just, you know, do ECW's greatest hits and don't look into any of the valid criticisms or the real story of, or the collateral damage of human beings and like what was happening. You know, at that point, it's just, you're just doing a wrestling video. That wasn't our aim. That's not satisfying to me. You know, so I want you to have to deal with the fact, and Kevin wants you to have to deal with the fact that this is a human being and he plays a character, but this is a real guy and this is his life and this is real, because it's very easy. If I had just put the names up there, it'd be very easy for somebody to walk through a room, maybe their brother's watching this, and they look and they go, oh, that's silly. You know, oh, look, he did that thing, that's fake. You know, this forces you to confront the human aspect of it. And I think that's very important given the subject matter that we're dealing with.
Since it's been screened, have you heard from some of the people that have appeared in the documentary, some of their initial thoughts now that they've got to actually see it all put together, and you know, positive and negative notes? Maybe you've heard from people that you have spoke with.
Yeah, I heard from. Well, I mean, Shane Douglas had seen it the week before, and then he was also at the premiere. So is Brian Heffron, who's, you know, the Blue Meanie, and should be noted as, like, has become a personal friend of mine. Brian's been great, and he loves it. He's seen it like 16 times at this point, and I'm only slightly exaggerating, to be honest with you. I think for a lot of these guys, it allows a window into a time where they felt more relevant. If I had to, like, psychoanalyze it. When we were screening it with Shane in Alabama, halfway through, he was just like so taken with that time period, and he made some comment to me about like wanting to jump through the screen and be back there, you know, which I thought was really interesting and a very genuine thought. You know, almost is more, you know, Troy Martin than it was Shane Douglas. I haven't heard any like massive, you know, negativity about it one way or the other. Axel was supposed to come to the premiere. We talked back and forth about it. He said that he was doing better. I said we put that at the end of the film. I'd heard an interview with him where I thought that he was, you know, he was on his way back, and I wanted him to be there. I said, you know, come and be part of the Q&A panel afterwards and, you know, show people that you're doing better, and he just never showed up, and I haven't heard from him one way or the other. It's slowly getting out there. I've heard from a few people that weren't in the film proper, but that may work, you know, elsewhere in the business, who can't go on record. And those people sent well wishes and their thoughts through mutual friends.
I do want to ask you about, because, you know, kind of the backdrop of this whole documentary is the modern day, the Extreme Reunion show that went on last April and trying to get things started again. And I really enjoyed that part of kind of looking back at kind of the glory days and then attempting to relive them, which is a theme throughout this documentary. The footage where you guys go with Shane when they get the call about Sabu, can you tell us about that? Because I felt very uneasy watching that part. part where that was filmed with Sabu being taken out of the hotel. Tell us about that decision to shoot that and just how that that day went for you guys.
I didn't shoot it. It would have been an interesting decision because you are there to document. I was at the building shooting. That was filmed by somebody in the company. I don't remember. It's not one of the main office people or, you know. It was somebody connected with, I think, Shane Douglas. They shot it on a flip cam. We became aware of it within a week. Are you guys still there?
Yes.
Okay. We became aware of it within a week of happening. We got the footage about a month later after we were requested to see it. And we sat on it for probably 2 months trying to figure out what to do. Because it's a documentary and you want to document and you want to show the realities of these things. And I think it definitely said something about the culture of these guys getting back together and what it was, you know, especially with the party scene segment that we did have in there. So it was like, I just let Kevin edit it. I just let him present it to me, and we tried to figure out what was the right line for it. You know what I mean? I think it's very revealing. It's very raw, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't want to run away from those things. What's interesting is that it's weird because I didn't film it, you know what I mean? And I, in the moment, I don't know how I would have felt because on one hand, you're going, well, I'm here to document, and I was given full access for the whole weekend, you know what I mean? But then again, like, you know, we were around Just Incredible a few times where he was having a lot of trouble that weekend.
Right.
And we didn't film. We decided not to film him. When we, especially at the end when we were in the back and they were, you know, removing him. It's just weird because I don't know how we would have dealt with it had we been made aware and told to, you know, if you want, you can jump in the car. This is what's happening. They filmed it for whatever reason. And, you know, like I said, we spent several months trying to figure out how to present that, you know. It did work with our dual narrative of what we were doing with the Extreme Reunion stuff and the original ECW stuff. So in the end, we made the decision to, you know, shoot it as kind of tastefully as possible.
Yeah. It was a very intriguing scene as well. And the way you explained that, I mean, that kind of goes to another area too that, I mean, I'm just always curious kind of the wrestling fan and the non-fan of how they view things. And, you know, whether it was Shane Douglas's call or whoever, who they get this call that this guy has passed out and found in a hotel room. Well, let's film this. It's just, mm-hmm. It's interesting that thought process.
They used it as promotion.
Yeah.
For their second show in June, that weekend. I knew that the video was out there. I saw it online, and I was like, it's weird because them using it is weird to me, but me using it makes more sense to me because we're documenting. It is odd the way it all came about, to be honest with you.
Well, John, we have been chatting with you for an hour here. It is flowing by, and I want to thank you very much for sitting down and chatting with us and kind of sharing your experiences here about Barbed Wire City. But I know that a lot of people who are listening to this, maybe they haven't seen the documentary as of yet, and I want them to know where they can go watch it, whether it be online or ordering a copy of it. And I know that you guys have a big screening coming up this weekend, so the platform is yours of where people can get more information on Barbed Wire City.
Thank you. Yeah, for all your Barbed Wire City needs, go to barbedwirecity.com and just check out the website. We have a store on there where you can get the DVD. We're trying to do the direct download thing, which should be easy for everybody. And there was a problem with the template, so I've been in a holding pattern for the last 2 or 3 days, which is driving me crazy. We just wanted to make it as user-friendly as possible. So there'll be a direct download up there, you know, maybe even by the time that this interview is out there, probably, actually. But yeah, you can also get a DVD there. You could get a T-shirt, a poster. I have blogs up there. You know, you can follow the different things we've been doing. That's barbedwirecity.com. The other thing on barbedwirecity.com is a little informational article about our New York City. It is a premiere in New York City, but it's really a screening. It's going to be at the Gramercy Theater, which is in Manhattan. Tickets are available through Ticketmaster. There's a link on the site, or if you just Google Barbed Wire City NYC, you'll be able to find where tickets are sold. I think they're selling for $15. But if you're in the New York area and you go to the Gramercy Theater box office, there's no surcharge on it. There's no the things that Ticketmaster does. You know, you can alleviate that problem. So that's going to be Saturday, this coming Saturday, May 4th. Doors open at 11, and the showing is actually at noon, so it's an earlier start time. And it's a very nice place. It's kind of overwhelming. Like, I mean, I didn't start doing this and then move to L.A. You know what I mean? I'm still, you know, I still live in Allentown and still like a normal dude, so it's kind of crazy to have a screening of your film in Manhattan. You know, it's very cool. I'm very lucky.
Are you planning to ever do any more wrestling projects, other documentary ideas that have spurred from this, or are you kind of just, everything is still kind of focused on this right now?
As far as Kevin Kiernan and our partnership, I mean, we've been friends since we were 2 years old. You know, this is the first time we worked together in like 6 years, but we had a really great experience, and we want to continue. We want to focus on... We really like telling stories about niche subcultures and humanizing them. So we want to do something with that, and it wouldn't be wrestling related. I promise Kevin that doesn't have to do anything more with wrestling at this point. I've gotten offers on my own to do some things, and there is a project that's kind of on the side that I just I'm being encouraged to do by others. It's going to be a little bit down the line, but it would be. I have a lot of footage of Ted Petty, and I have a lot of footage of Johnny Grunge, and the Johnny Grunge interview was actually taped the day that he flew in for the memorial of Ted Petty after he had passed.
Oh, wow.
So there's just a lot of stuff that just did not fit into our narrative, but that is about those two. And I was thinking, well, what can we do that would be good? I mean, you know, there's a little following of people who like, you know, the Public Enemy, that tag team. So I thought maybe, you know, a little bit down the line, I could shoot a few more interviews, you know, do a shorter video, you know, documentary style video about those two, and maybe, you know, get in touch with the families, and we could do something good for the families and have their involvement in some way, and, you know, have some proceeds go to them. That's obviously a very niche wrestling product as compared to what we're shooting for, what we hope to be shooting for with this. That's one, and then there's like one or two other, you know, things on the table. I don't know that I want to just go into wrestling projects again. I kind of like want to branch out and do other things, but there is a part of me that goes, well, you kind of know the world. You know, you could do, I have an opportunity to do something kind of unique that, you know, you wouldn't get from other sources within wrestling. So it's a thought, you know what I mean? We'll see.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on the documentary to you and Kevin and your whole team that you worked with on this. Once again, barbedwirecity.com. You can follow them on Twitter at BWCfilm. And John, all the best moving forward with the rollout of the documentary. And I want to thank you very much for stopping by. This has been great chatting with you.
Thank you guys for giving me a platform to, you know, talk about this in some kind of abstract terms or some kind of outside of the realm of wrestling terms. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you guys giving me the time. I had a lot of fun.
All right. So thank you very much to John for sitting down with us for an hour there to chat about the documentary.
Maybe he was standing.
Oh, he could have been standing the whole time. Yeah, we didn't actually ask him what his...
Could have been doing jumping jacks?
He could have been, perhaps. Oh. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, we are going to on over to some feedback.
Yeah, that's right.
And a couple people have seen the documentary. It's only been out for a couple of weeks. So let's dive into that right now. And do you want to start us off, Way?
Yes. Yes, I do. I do so much. And I will do that right
Do you want
now.
Me to start?
No, I'll start.
Okay.
All right. This comes from Flam, who says, people tend to shit on TNN, the channel, yes. But that was the era when I got into ECW, and I absolutely loved it. Even after it folded, I constantly watched tapes and DVDs to learn more about it. With that out of the way, Barbed Wire City is a mixed bag. I wish I hadn't rewatched Forever Hardcore 2 weeks ago, because this sort of felt like more of the same. We've already heard all the stories in regards to mass transit, barely legal, etc., but it was great to learn about some things I didn't know about, like Tony Lewis. It's amazing how passionate some fans are. As a New Yorker, I'm glad the Elks Lodge was highlighted. Philly wasn't the only integral market for ECW. I loved the fan cam footage. That's probably the best part of the film. And while it was a bit gimmicky, I liked the 3D effect they used for the photos. The segments dedicated to the Dudleys, Stevie Richards, Tommy Dreamer, and Eddie Gilbert were all positives. Loved all of the Heyman footage, too. We got to learn more about him in this video, both the good and the bad, but this was the first time his negative qualities were really talked about in depth. While it was already well documented, you didn't really get the impression he was a charismatic persuader here. I love the footage of a hopeful Balls Mahoney being 100% confident that Paul was only going through a Chapter 11 reorganization shortly after ECW folded. On the subject of Balls, wow, it's sad to see where he's at. He's only 41, but looks like complete shit. His lifestyle isn't a secret, but it's still depressing to see him like this. It was equally sad seeing Axel Rotten in the state he's in. In interviews, he's always seemed like a genuinely nice and bright guy. While we didn't get too many interviews from the top stars of ECW, it was nice to see some of the lesser-known wrestlers like Angel and Nova get some screen time. Public Enemy telling stories is also one of the highlights. Too much time was dedicated to journalists giving their perspective on things, though. Wade Keller got more screen time than anyone. At first, it seemed like Extreme Reunion was being glorified and romanticized here, but I'm glad it wasn't. What a terrible and disastrous show. In fact, you guys should review it eventually. Ted Petty saying he was doing Mexican flips before the Mexicans were doing them was hilarious. Rocco Rock, the innovator of Lucha Libre.
Those that, you know, didn't really follow Ted Petty. I mean, he was formerly the Cheetah Kid, where he was, you know, at the time in the Northeast scene was a very different performer than people will recall from Rocco Rock. And it was, you know, pretty much a complete gimmick change into Public Enemy. So, I mean, in the early 90s, he was, you know, one of the top independent talents. We go into Remy from Portsmouth. Although I haven't seen the documentary, there is a reason for me not wanting to seek it out. The ECW story has been done to death, and to be honest, I just wish people would let it die. How many DVDs, documentaries, and failed tribute promotions must there be before the ECW fan base finally ceases its incessant rhetoric of how great it was and how special it was, and all the noise about its special bond with the fans, etc.? I feel that ECW was always overrated, and people have always been overly nostalgic about it. Please let us move on from it. You can't move forward if you're stuck in the past. I'm going to completely disagree with that, because I don't see how you can argue that people are way too nostalgic and then say that none of this has been successful. Extreme Reunion got tons of criticism and drew 2,000 fans. I mean, you can't deny that there is a market here for people that look back at this promotion very fondly, performers included. And I don't know. To me, I don't have an issue if, you know, people want to present a story from their own perspective, and if there's a market for it, that's going to bear if there's interest or not for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like saying, you know, I really like Kiss, but I don't think they should play concerts anymore because I've already seen them once.
Why is the WWE bringing back The Rock? Let the Attitude Era die. It's done.
I think there's definitely a limit and a threshold of how often you could do nostalgia. But, you know, like they say in the documentary, like once every few years, I think is fine.
If there's people that are willing to pay for it, then it's hard to argue with that.
Dave from Ohio. I spent my formative teenage years watching ECW on a low-power local TV station, so I was very excited to get my copy of this. From the get-go, it was evident to me that a lot of love went into making this. The fan cam footage was great, the interviews were all good, and I feel this did a much better job than the WWE-produced docs in terms of telling the full story of ECW from beginning to end. The only thing I felt this was lacking was that one big interview, someone like Tommy Dreamer, for example, where their attempts to reach out to guys like Tommy or RVD or Sabu. And I believe he answered that.
Yeah.
All in all, though, this was a great purchase, captivating from start to finish, and highly recommended, especially for older ECW fans or those disappointed with WWE's efforts.
And Peter from Denmark, the idea to not have a voiceover narrate the story, but instead have constant cuts between the talking heads, made it confusing to follow, and the payoff with the reunion show didn't do anything for me. What I did like and would love to have heard more of was the interviews with the diehard fans. I wish there had been more focus on their background and the environment they came from, especially since the title Barbed Wire City sort of promises a look outside the bingo hall. I feel, if he's talking about just the Philadelphia thing, I think that was something they clearly did with dedicating a whole section to kind of the Philadelphia-New York rivalry for the company. Mm-hmm. So
there you go. That was our feedback to Barbed Wire City. So thanks to those of you that have checked it out or provided feedback for us. And hopefully most of the questions we did get to with John that people asked as well. So that is going to wrap things up. Once again, the documentary is available at barbedwirecity.com if you want to purchase the documentary and check it out for yourself. But next week, Wei, what are we going to review?
You tell me.
Well, I figured we could stick on the ECW front and go back and watch a show from their history, going back 15 years to watch the ECW Heatwave pay-per-view from 1998, featuring, among other things, there was a tag match involving Rob Van Dam and Sabu against Jinsei Shinzaki and Hayabusa.
Yeah.
And
awesome.
Hayabusa. So that's going to be coming up next week. ECW Heatwave 98. So we can ECW Nostalgia next week. So look out.
Yeah, watch out. Maybe this is too much and we should move on.
Yeah. So that's going to be coming up next week. In the meantime, you can go check out liveaudiowrestling.com for more shows, more information, all that stuff. At Wei0937 on Twitter. What are you tweeting about these days, Wei? I feel we give out these... these Twitter handles, and it's a, what do I get if I follow Wei Ting on Twitter other than a logo of the Clips?
What the hell was my, no, it's not the Clips.
Who is it?
It's a drawing of a shirt of a Biggie and Jay-Z.
Oh.
Well, my last tweet was April 30th edition of Reveal Raw. Click here to download.
Oh, that's nice. What was your last,
You know, I don't so much tweet, but, I do a lot of responding to people. So if you tweet at me, you're very likely to get a response. Oh, okay. Well, my last actual tweet was a photo of Gordon passed out watching a UFC 159 at the bar.
There you go. That's a selling feature there.
Yeah.
So WAI0937. Why the 0937?
Why? I don't know.
People want to know.
Why not?
Of all the numbers in the world.
Why not? I am John Pollock.
Because John Pollock's taken, so what else am I going to do?
John Pollock.
I could be a dick and write the John Pollock. That's pretty.
You think that's egotistical?
Yeah, I think so.
Well, for me, I don't know, man. I think I just, this is kind of, it's always been my screen name for a while, and it would be my screen name anyway, even if I wasn't trying to promote shit.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. Give away a follow, and he'll write back to you if you tweet him.
Yeah.
Just say hello to him. Ask him why the four numbers at the end of his name.
I don't know why you're saying all this with a smirk on your face, like some type of smartass.
I'm not being a smartass. I'm just a happy person. That's all.
What a dick.
All right. Well, you can follow me at I am John Pollock, because that's a fact. I am John Pollock.
Okay.
It's not a lie. And next week, Heatwave 98. Go subscribe, iTunes, Stitcher. All that stuff, and a song to get us out of here, Mr. Ting.
Well, what song to you represents the Barbed Wire City?
Well, I don't know. If there was a warning for a heat wave coming to Toronto,
okay.
What would you want to listen to?
All right, I got one. You just got to give me 1 second, because before I even got to see ECW at all, the first time I ever saw ECW was in a music video by 3-6 Mafia.
Oh, really?
And, it was weird, because, like, here's the video, and it was just, like, these rappers, these southern rappers, and interspersed with footage from ECW, like, of, like, Bam Bam Bigelow getting speared through the stage and all that. I just thought that was so weird. So weird and bizarre, but awesome. So here is Hit 'Em by 3-6 Mafia.
All right. 3-6 Mafia takes us out, and we will chat with you later on this week, and then next week, a review of ECW Heatwave 98.